It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, we'll get the latest news from the public impeachment hearings. First, it's Food Friday, and this week it's a new twist on a classic, specifically a classic cookbook. Joy of Cooking, first published in 1931 by Irma Rombauer, has found a spot in many of our kitchens. It's been revised here and there over the years, and now it's got a major update while staying within the family. The latest edition has added about 600 new recipes, revised some older ones, and expanded its instructional sections to help a new generation of home chefs. John Becker is the great-grandson of Irma Rombauer and one of the authors of the new edition. John, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you for having us. Great to be here.
And Megan Scott has been with the Joy of Cooking team for about a decade. She's worked with her husband, John, to write this updated version. Megan, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much.
Well, John, a lot of us might have that recipe collection from great grandma or the old cookbook from our family, and you've got Joy of Cooking. Is that a lot of pressure to steward this this huge collection of recipes?
It's definitely a great responsibility. We know the significance we have for a lot of families across the country. We definitely took revising this book seriously.
Megan, what goes into deciding which recipes to add to a collection like this, which ones to take out, which ones to revise?
It's really a case-by-case basis. So when we were first starting the revision process, we went through the book, the previous edition that came out in 2006, line by line several times and created a huge outline. So anywhere we felt there was something missing from a chapter or anything that needed to be fact-checked or edited, we made note of that. And then we went in and actually started doing the revision. So we had a really clear idea of what we were going to do before we even got started. We wanted to really represent, how our Americans cooking now? What kinds of ingredients do people have access to? What kind of flavor profiles do people love? So those are things that we really took into account when thinking about what to add and what to take out.
And that's a big point about Joy of Cooking, this new version. John, can you talk about things that are here now in 2019 that might not have been so commonplace back in, say, 1931?
Well, it's hard to know where to start. In 1931, we didn't have pressure cookers. Those came, well, at least we started talking about them in 1939. Garlic was they would come in like little boxes and it was very hard to find and used very, very, judiciously.
And even some things, that we take for granted now, like soy sauce, you just did not have soy sauce in 1931. So Irma actually had a recipe for, was it chow mein?
That's right.
Chow mein in the 1931 edition, but she did not use soy sauce because it just wasn't really available to her.
Wow. Okay. So that's some big changes. Also, you've put a lot more attention into updating the food safety and nutritional side of things, Megan. Can you talk about the focus there?
Yeah, we really wanted to have a more robust section on food safety because we think, home cooks now are not necessarily starting with the same base of knowledge that their parents or grandparents did. And it's important to cover all those bases so that people are really safe in the kitchen. So we did actually write a new section on food safety that lives in the nutrition chapter, which was also completely revised. And we were also taking into account things like, people wanting to, even if they're not a vegetarian or a vegan, wanting to eat less meat and more flavorful vegetable dishes.
And John, speaking of making this accessible to someone who may not have the same cooking knowledge as someone who might have come in 1931, that's always been kind of the approach of Joy of Cooking, right? This is not something pitched to the gourmet chef. This is something that people could start off with and then keep working throughout their cooking lives.
Absolutely. Since the first edition, I think our goal has been to kind of deprofessionalize cooking for the home cook. And, now we really do try to speak to all skill levels, really. So, we want to be there for the beginner when they're just starting out and really don't need to get their bearings in the kitchen, but also have reference material and, just some really solid reference information for those of us who might need a refresher every now and then.
Talking to John Becker and Megan Scott about a cookbook that's been in their family for a couple generations. It's Joy of Cooking. They're out with a new revised edition, a lot of new recipes, a lot of the old classics still there. Love to hear from you, by the way, at 800-642-1234. Is Joy of Cooking part of your own cooking heritage? Is it on your bookshelf right now? Did it help you too? Enjoy cooking and get better at it. Call in and share your maybe favorite recipe from the book, 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Well, you've shared, Megan and John, a couple of recipes with us. We've got that online at wpr.org/foodfriday. I'll throw this one in, and either of you can run with this one if you want. The whole berry cranberry sauce, very timely recipe for the month of November. Tell us about this one.
Yeah, well, we really love making a homemade cranberry sauce for Thanksgiving because it's so easy. I think it takes about 10 minutes to make. It's got maybe two or three ingredients. Of course, you can flavor it any way you want. Sometimes we like to add orange zest or spices like a whole cinnamon stick or star anise. And sometimes we'll even add some port at the end for a nice kick. But it's one of those Thanksgiving sides that you can actually make up to a week ahead of time, maybe even a little bit more. So you can get that out of the way so you don't even have to think about it.
Is this something that you are just going to restrict to your Thanksgiving table, or are you willing to eat a cranberry sauce like this any time of year?
Oh, I mean, anytime. You know, I think it does get relegated to Thanksgiving, but we love it anytime.
And John, a lot of cookbooks have a section in each recipe for ingredients, another for directions. In The Joy of Cooking, it's got its own approach. It's mixed together step by step. How important do you think that, and that was, I think, from the original, right? How important is that to its accessibility?
That's incredibly important. Actually, Irma published the first edition, self-published the first edition, and then developed that recipe format before she published the 1936 edition with Bob's Merrill, Midwestern publisher. So the ingredients and the directions are mixed together, and it really helps you follow along in the kitchen. So you're not necessarily like going back and forth between the directions and a list of ingredients, which can get, you know, I mean, when you're juggling pans, or, you know, trying to prep onions while something else is going on, it can be a little bit overwhelming. So we think that format is really great for, especially for beginning cooks.
And Megan, there's a big section, I don't know if this is brand new, a big chapter on salting, drying, and fermenting. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, actually, Joya's had sections on salting, smoking, and drying for a while, but the fermentation section is new, and we did revamp all those other sections as well. You know, Joya's had a recipe for sauerkraut for many years, but we never really described the process of fermentation, so what's happening when you ferment something, how to know when something you're fermenting is ready to eat. So we wanted to provide all those guidelines for home cooks, and it's really, we love those kinds of DIY kitchen projects. They take a little bit more time, but they're really rewarding because it's kind of an interesting way to build up your pantry.
And John, yeah, I think of fermenting as something that somebody else does for me. I buy it in the jar after they've done it. It's an industrial process. It's kind of cool bringing it back to home cooks, which is where it had been for, what, centuries before that.
Yeah, you know, it's super low effort, and it, you know, after you do a few batches, get those under your belt, it really is, it's just a friendly thing to do. You know, it's just
it becomes
easy.
Pretty intuitive once you get the hang of it. Yeah, and you can kind of ferment anything, so you can really explore.
And John, I wanted to ask, do you hear from people when people find out who you are and, you know, who your great-grandma was and your connection to the book, do you hear a lot of stories and anecdotes about people's connection to Joy of Cooking?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, we have gotten some really heartfelt communications since we started. So we are the people behind Joy's social media presence. And of course, you know, we field emails all the time and, you know, get things in the actual mail. And, you know, I think that, what was it? A few years ago, we received a paperback edition that was just destroyed. you know, like it was basically just, you know, a stack of paper, like in a Ziploc bag, along with an accompanying note that was just like the sweetest thing ever. It really, this woman was saying that, you know, she was going into a nursing home and, you know, she didn't think that her daughters would appreciate the stack of papers. But she wanted to let us know that, you know, that the Joy of Cooking had, you know, gotten her, had seen her through three marriages, helped her raise six children and, you know, numerous grandchildren, had been through a flood.
Wow.
You know? And, you know, it just really, it speaks to the kind of special relationship that at least we think that we have with our, you know, most of our readers. And
we're talking to John Becker and Megan Scott right now. They're behind Joy of Cooking's latest edition. It features hundreds of new recipes, among other things. You can join in at 800-642-1234. was joy of cooking a part of your kitchen growing up, maybe your parents' kitchen growing up? Has it helped you learn how to cook, bake, ferment now? What questions do you have for our guests about their work updating a classic or cooking itself? Do you have a favorite recipe from the book that you've used over the over your cooking career? Is there a hand-me-down copy that was maybe in a little better shape than that one in the plastic bag? Call us at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. And by the way, find out a few recipes that John and Megan shared with us. We have those at WPR.org/Food Friday. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. It's Food Friday. We continue our conversation with John Becker and Megan Scott. They are co-authors, or the most recent authors, of the new edition of The Joy of Cooking. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have memories of using Joy of Cooking in your kitchen? Is that memory from last night or from years ago? Did you grow up with the book? Learn from it? Do you have cooking questions for our guests? Is there a favorite recipe from the book? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll go to your calls now. Maggie is with us in Waukesha. Maggie, hi.
Hi. Well, I wanted to let you know that my favorite recipe in the cookbook is the rum chocolate mousse on page 738 from the 1975 edition.
It's funny you mentioned that. We actually brought it back for the new edition.
Oh, yay.
Yeah,
we love that one. It's excellent.
And Maggie, what is it about this one that sticks with you?
Oh, it's delicious, and it's something that is requested by my sons and their friends. It's an all-around favorite, I've managed to make it into pies and other things also. It's and my sons actually had they're both young adults now, and they both requested if I would get them that specific edition of The Joy of Cooking, which I happen to be able to find at Half Price Books.
Maggie, thank you so much for sharing that. What a great story. And actually, that reminds me, she said she took this this thing and made it into a pie. And there's a bit, Megan, in the book where you talk about, you know, when you stick to the recipe, when you can kind of freewheel a little bit.
Yeah, we expect our readers to kind of go off script a little bit. That's kind of the way people have treated The Joy of Cooking for a long time, is that there are a lot of really great basic recipes that can be riffed on. And we think it's really fun to, you know, not stick to the recipe all the time.
Thanks a lot. Oh, go ahead, John.
We certainly don't.
Yeah.
Thanks for that call. And I wanted to ask, and John, this is a terrible question to ask you, but I'm going to ask you anyway, is there a recipe that you have, you know, maybe from growing up around The Joy of Cooking cookbook that that has stuck with you, that's one that you used to go to and maybe now make yourself?
Yeah, well, you know, my father, you know, when... So my father lived in... my father, Ethan, lived in Cincinnati. And so, you know, we would go to get to the chili parlor, have the, you know, this Greek Macedonian style Cincinnati chili. And he actually developed a recipe for that. That's really, really good. And yeah, I make that every now and then, because I don't get to Cincinnati very often anymore, but definitely crave that dish.
Let's go back to our callers. Therese is with us in Stoughton. Therese, hi.
Hi, how are you today?
Good. What do you want to tell us about, Therese?
Well, back in the 80s, I was a commercial fisherman in Alaska, and I was a young girl, and I knew nothing about cooking. And The Joy of Cooking came on board with me, and I used that to cook for the entire summer that I was working on the fishing boat. And I didn't even know how to boil eggs. So it was really important for me to be able to cook. So I did that, and I've had two other copies since then, you know, two different renditions, and I still have that old one, and it sounds like that one caller where, you know, it was down to papers and just barely hanging in there together.
I got to ask, Therese, is this, you're cooking for yourself, or are you cooking for the whole crew here?
No, it was a crew of four.
Oh, okay.
Low man on the totem pole, you ended up doing more of the cooking than everyone else did.
Oh, that's a fantastic story, Therese. Thank you so much. So, John, the cookbook is probably stained with salt water at this point. Joy of Cooking's probably been everywhere on the planet at this point, I'm guessing.
No, yeah. Marion would get communiques from all over, from expats all over the world, really.
And we've heard from folks who, you know, maybe they were stationed in another country in the army or the military, and, you know, young wives who are trying to learn how to cook. And definitely have heard a lot of stories of people trying to navigate places all over the world.
Well, and then also, I remember, like, when we first started running the social media accounts for Joy, we got a woman who was doing some work in South Africa was coming to us with some really, you know, kind of in-depth questions about solar cooking and
bread baking.
Wow.
We're talking about the classic cookbook, Joy of Cooking. John Becker and Megan Scott are the authors of the newest generation of the book. Back to your calls now at 800-642-1234. Miriam is with us in Madison. Miriam, hello.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. My mom is from a European country, and so cooking American was different for her. And she married a GI and had asked for their for a wedding gift for an American cookbook. And she got a different type of cookbook. Over probably about like 18 years later, she had picked Joy Cooking up, and she gave that to me for a high school graduation gift. And she said that she had wished that she had that when she was learning to cook.
Fantastic.
But I don't know whatever happened to that cookbook, but I remember love reading it. I've picked things up from that book, as well as my travels around the world, and just trial and error. But that was definitely a fun reading for me right out of high school. So thank you. I can't wait to see the new edition.
Miriam, thank you so much. And Megan, the production of the cookbook, Joy of Cooking, has gone through generations, and we're hearing from people who have had multi-generational uses of the cookbook, too.
Yeah, and, you know, I actually didn't grow up in a Joy of Cooking family, but when I moved out of my parents' house, I was actually in college and kind of living on my own for the first time. I bought myself a Joy of Cooking because I just knew, I somehow intuitively, that this was the kitchen Bible that was going to teach me everything I needed to know.
Thanks a lot for that call. Jim joins us next in Watertown. Jim, hi.
Hello. Thanks for taking the call. Yes, my mom learned to perfect her cooking with the Joy of Cooking and passed it on to me, and I use it myself for mainly for the poultry barbecue as a base recipe. I mean, I've changed it around a little bit to give it my own flavor, but and I've passed one on to my daughter. So thank you all very much.
Jim, thank you so much. That's another great multi-generational Joy of Cooking story. Hey, you like chicken, Jim. I should mention another recipe you guys shared with us, chicken makini masala. A lot of spices in this one. Either of you, again, can tackle this. Tell us about this chicken makini masala.
Well, it's great. It actually involves, grilling the chicken. You put a nice char on the chicken, you know, cook it through, and then it actually at that point goes into a nice masala, so a tomato sauce with tempered spices. So the spices are fried before you add the onions and the garlic and the ginger. It's just a fantastic dish. It's also known as butter chicken and tikka masala sometimes, but definitely worth checking out. It's a little bit of an extra effort, but if you, for instance, want to grill the chicken one night, then a double batch of it, then you have leftovers to make the masala the next night. That's what I like to do.
We've got that online at WPR.org/Food Friday. Well, we're here in Wisconsin, and Megan, I understand you've been a cheesemaker's apprentice. You two first connected, do I have this right, over a love of blue cheese?
Yes, that was one of the first conversations we had was about cheese, and I am very passionate about cheese. I love all kinds of cheese, particularly the very stinky ones. So it was important to me that I date a person who also loved stinky cheese.
Let's take another caller. Gene is with us driving through Wisconsin, it sounds like. Gene, hello.
Hi. First of all, I'd like to say thank you for the Joy of Cooking. One of the greatest things I learned from the book was how to thicken sauces and soups. it was something that was always kind of a mystery, and I ended up with a lot of lumps before I got that book. And secondly, I'd like to ask, now, is there a general rule of thumb of how long home canned goods, when they've been canned properly, are good on the shelf?
Ooh, okay. Thanks for the comment, Gene, and any advice on when we can our own stuff. Maybe we canned a lot of stuff this fall. How long that's going to be safe?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think the general rule of thumb is 2 years. And honestly, you know, things will probably usually be safe after that point, but they do start to deteriorate in quality and just not taste as good.
Yeah, and, it, you know, when in doubt, throw it out. You know, that's, that is really the, you know, if you can tell that the seal in any way has been compromised, we actually store all of our canned goods with the rings off. And I think that, the USDA actually does recommend you do that. But it's definitely something good to keep in mind, because that way, with the rings off, you can really tell when something, you know, when something's not right.
Mm-hmm.
Gene, thanks a lot for that call. John told us about that Cincinnati-style chili. Megan, do you have a favorite go-to recipe from some incarnation of Joy of Cooking?
Well, one of my favorite recipes from the new edition is it's an olive oil cake. So it's this really rich, it's almost like a pound cake, but kind of Italian pound cake. So it's made with olive oil instead of butter. It has some cornmeal in it and some orange zest and orange juice. And I love serving it all year long with whatever fruit is in season. It's kind of a one bowl cake, so it's super easy to make and really flavorful.
Well, cake is a good place to wrap things up. Megan and John, thank you so much for joining us today.
Yeah, thank you so much for having us.
It's a pleasure to be here.
John Becker and Megan Scott are the authors of The Joy of Cooking's latest edition. The book was first published by John's great-grandmother, Irma Rombauer, in 1931. We've got three recipes that they shared with us at WPR.org/Food Friday. We talked about the chicken makini masala, the whole berry cranberry sauce, get that ready for Thanksgiving, and then one bonus one, a banana bread cacane. So check those out. Make them over the weekend if you'd like. Again, they're at WPR.org/Food Friday. Former U.S. Ambassador to Ukraine, Marie Yovanovitch, testified publicly before the House Intelligence Committee today as part of the impeachment inquiry. Here's a moment from Yovanovitch's opening testimony.
Perhaps it was not surprising that when our anti-corruption efforts got in the way of a desire for profit or power, Ukrainians who preferred to play by the old corrupt rules sought to remove me. What continues to amaze me is that they found Americans willing to partner with them, and working together, they apparently succeeded in orchestrating the removal of a U.S. ambassador. How could our system fail like this? How is it that foreign corrupt interests could manipulate our government? Which country's interests are served when the very corrupt behavior we have been criticizing is allowed to prevail?
Yovanovitch served as a member of the U.S. Foreign Service for 33 years and is still a member of that Foreign Service. She was the ambassador to Ukraine before being abruptly recalled by President Trump in May. She was mentioned by Trump in the phone call between him and the newly elected Ukrainian president. That phone call served as part of the basis for the whistleblower complaint that led to this impeachment inquiry. Our next guest has been covering the testimony and joins us now. Scott Wong is a senior staff writer for The Hill covering House leadership. Scott, welcome back to Central Time.
Hey, Rob. Thanks for having me.
What were the biggest takeaways from today, the second day of public testimony in this impeachment inquiry?
Well, I think one takeaway certainly was that Yovanovitch was a credible, sympathetic witness for Democrats. She appeared genuine. She recounted a little bit about her history of working for Republican and Democratic administrations going back all the way to Ronald Reagan in various dangerous countries around the world. She talked about how in some cases she came under fire in some of these posts. And so she had credibility, and that was important for Democrats. She talked about how it was highly unusual for for this conspiracy of Rudy Giuliani and Ukrainian government officials conspiring with folks in the United States to remove her as ambassador, because they saw her as somebody who was standing in the way of their business and political interests. So it was gripping testimony, and obviously what was different, if people thought Wednesday's hearing lacked any drama. This one did not lack that drama because the president himself was watching it and tweeting attacks on Yovanovitch in real time, which was something to behold.
I wanted to bring that up. During the testimony, President Trump criticized Yovanovitch on Twitter, as you just mentioned. House Intelligence Committee Chair Adam Schiff then brought up the tweets more or less in real time. Here's Schiff's exchange with Yovanovitch quoting President Trump's tweet.
Everywhere Marie Yovanovitch went turned bad. She started off in Somalia. How did that go? He goes on to say, later in the tweet, is a U.S. president's absolute right to appoint ambassadors. First of all, Ambassador Yovanovitch, the Senate has a chance to confirm or deny an ambassador, do they not?
Yes, advise and consent.
But would you like to respond to the president's attack that everywhere you went turned bad?
Well, I don't think I have such powers, not in Mogadishu, Somalia, and not in other places. I actually think that where I've served over the years, I and others have demonstrably made things better, you know, for the U.S. as well as for the countries that I've served in.
Schiff said the president's attacks amounted to witness intimidation. What's been some of the other response to that, Scott?
Well, that's exactly right. And Democrats, as they were exiting from the hearing and taking a break to run to votes, members of the Intelligence Committee, specifically the Democrats, were saying this was a blatant example of witness intimidation. People like Eric Swalwell and Jackie Speier, who participated in the questioning today, said it is possible that this episode of the president tweeting attacks on Yovanovitch as she is testifying before Congress under oath, that that could be perceived as witness intimidation that could be included in the articles of impeachment under one of them, which would be obstruction of justice. And so, you know, it was a dramatic moment. We've obviously never been in this environment, this media environment before, where the president can respond to the witness who is testifying in the president's impeachment investigation in real time on Twitter. So it was a dramatic moment and shocked a lot of people on Capitol Hill.
Talking to Scott Wong from The Hill about the latest in the impeachment inquiry, the public side of that inquiry that started this week. I want to give a listen now to Ranking Member Devin Nunes, a Republican from California, very critical of the whole process. Here he is in an exchange with Yovanovitch today.
Were you involved in the deliberations about the pause in military sales to Ukraine as the Trump administration reviewed newly elected President Zelensky's commitment to corruption reforms?
For the delay in...
For the pause.
The pause? No, I was not.
Were you involved in the proposed Trump-Zelensky, later Pence-Zelensky meetings in Warsaw, Poland on September 1st?
No, I was not.
Did you ever talk to President Trump in 2019?
No, I have not.
Mick Mulvaney?
No, I have not.
Thank you, Ambassador. Not exactly sure what the ambassador is doing here today. This is the House Intelligence Committee that's now turned into the House Impeachment Committee. This seems more appropriate for the Subcommittee on Human Resources at the Foreign Affairs Committee. If there's issues with employment disagreements with the administration, it would seem like this would be a more appropriate setting instead of an impeachment hearing where the ambassador is not a material fact witness to anything, any of the accusations that are being hurled at the president for this impeachment inquiry.
Scott, was this a running theme for Republican critics of the process that this is not a direct witness to the pieces of the accusations against the president?
That's exactly right. And that seems to be more and more the central argument for Republicans, that people like Yovanovitch and also the witnesses who came before Congress on Wednesday, Bill Taylor and George Kent, are not firsthand witnesses of the president's reasons for withholding aid to Ukraine, that $400 million that we've been talking about. And so whereas before, much of the Republican arguments had been around process and their gripes with how the process was going because it was being run by the Democrats, it seems like Republicans are now starting to rally behind this central argument, which is that we haven't heard from any of the firsthand witnesses who would have been in direct communication with President Trump as to why he was withholding that aid and whether it had anything to do with investigations he wanted into the Bidens. Now, I will say that at the very moment as the hearing was wrapping up, there was another witness, David Holmes, who is an aide to Bill Taylor, the acting ambassador to Ukraine, who arrived on Capitol Hill and stepped into the SCIF, the secret closed-door hearing rooms for the Intelligence Committee. And he is somebody who apparently overheard a phone call with President Trump and his ambassador to the EU, Gordon Sondland. So he is, Democrats are saying, a firsthand witness, and he is now at the moment giving testimony behind closed doors to Democrats and Republicans.
And there's been also criticism that the fact that the U.S. ambassador to Ukraine wasn't in the loop on a decision of whether to provide military aid to Ukraine might be a symptom of the problems that the former ambassador was pointing out there.
Can you repeat that again? I wasn't
following. Democrats have been saying the fact that the ambassador to Ukraine wasn't a firsthand witness to decisions made about Ukraine is part of the wider problem.
Yeah, I mean, for Democrats, the reason why they think that Yovanovitch is such an important witness is they believe that she is, she was pushed out of the way, they believe, by President Trump and Rudy Giuliani and others because that Republicans and Trump saw her as standing in the way of getting some of these politically motivated investigations into the Bidens and into these unsubstantiated claims that it was Ukraine rather than Russia that had been doing the interfering in the 2016 election. And so the Democrats' challenge, of course, is to try to tie this all together, tie Yovanovitch's ouster with, with the military aid and with these politically motivated investigations that Taylor and George Kent talked about on Wednesday. And of course, we have a series of other hearings that will be happening next week. This is just one week of public hearings, and there will be at least one more before Thanksgiving.
And before we wrap up, another piece of news today. Roger Stone, President Trump's former aide and friend, found guilty on 7 counts related to obstructing a congressional investigation into Russian interference in the 2016 election. What do we know about these charges?
Well, this was related to the previous Mueller-Russia investigation. And, I don't have all the details, but as you mentioned, there was obstruction of justice. There was lying to Congress while under oath. And also the third one, which was fascinating because of the timing of it, which was witness tampering. It came on the day, obviously, that Democrats were accusing the president of tampering with the witness, Ms. Yovanovitch. And so this is yet another person that was in President Trump's orbit has been convicted on charges and will be heading to prison in terms of being part of the Russia investigation. It is interesting that these two investigations are still moving on sort of a parallel track, that we're seeing arrests and convictions in the Mueller investigation as the Ukraine investigation is just getting going.
Scott, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks so much, Rob.
That's Scott Wong, senior staff writer for The Hill, covering House leadership. You join us with the latest news from the public impeachment hearings. Foxconn's development in Racine County got the go-ahead in 2017 as part of a deal that offered the company more than $4 billion in state and local tax incentives. It's one of the most high-profile, but definitely not the only example of private companies getting public incentives to relocate, or in some cases, stay where they are. Our next guest says more often than not, those packages don't pay off. But he thinks there are ways leaders can offer incentives that let more people share in the benefits of new businesses. Timothy Bardick is a senior economist at the W.E. Upjohn Institute. He's the author of the book, Making Sense of Incentives, Taming Business Incentives to Promote Prosperity. Tim, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me on.
Why do you say that in most cases, business incentives don't pay off for the community paying them?
Well, incentives do lower costs some for businesses, but there are a lot of other costs. Incentives, the average incentive amounts to about 3% of wages. So even modest changes in worker productivity or the quality of local infrastructure can easily make a difference. And so in many cases, you're offering incentives to a company, it would have made the same decision anyway. In other cases, maybe that company would have gone away. Maybe they really want incentives, but some other company might have chosen the same parcel of land you're trying to market.
One thing you focus on is the idea of multiplier. The person making the case for an incentive might say, okay, yeah, we're putting a lot of money in, and the company itself will generate this money, but X amount of times of that are going to spill over in, you know, the businesses that supply this and in real estate and this and that. You say we need to look more closely at that so-called multiplier effect.
Well, multipliers are definitely real. I mean, you bring in a company, it will buy from local suppliers. The workers go out and buy from local retailers. That's true. But it's also true that when you bring in a company, it drives up local costs, land costs, housing costs, wage costs, et cetera. So that's going to discourage other business growth. A lot of times, the multipliers that are cited by state economic development agencies don't take account of these negative cost feedbacks. When you take account of those negative cost feedbacks, the actual net multiplier is reduced by about a third. I mean, if someone claims the multiplier is 3, that if for every one job you get 2 additional jobs, the true number might be for every one job you get 1 additional job, 2.
Here in Wisconsin, when we think of business incentive, we probably think of the Foxconn deal. We've talked to you about this before, but can you remind us how the Foxconn investment from state and local governments stacks up compared to other incentives around the country?
It's about 10 times the average in the country. I mean, as I said, the average incentive is equivalent to essentially subsidizing wages by 3% for 20 years. With the Foxconn deal, the original offer, was essentially equivalent to subsidizing wages by about 30% over 20 years, 10 times the usual thing, which led to, frankly, a lot of the national attention to this. A lot of policy people around the country said, look, if someone like Foxconn becomes general, this is what every state does to attract business, incentives end up costing $500 billion a year nationally, which is about 30% of state and local tax revenue, which would have a major impact on the ability of state and local governments to provide public services. So I think people were kind of freaked out by the notion that Foxconn might lead to a real burden on the ability of state and local governments to provide adequate public services.
Talking to Timothy Bardick, senior economist at the W.E. Upjohn Institute and author of the book Making Sense of Incentives, Taming Business Incentives to Promote Prosperity. He's talking about the use and misuse of incentives to either bring businesses into a community or to get them to stay there. But, Tim, you say there is a better way. What's a more effective way to use an incentive at the local or state level?
Well, I think if you limit the amount of the incentive, so you're not, breaking the bank, and if you combine that with services that I think are more cost-effective in boosting jobs, that package will work better. So, for example, I like what Virginia did to attract Amazon. They offered incentives that are equivalent to essentially saying to Amazon, for each job you create, we'll make you a one-time payment of $20,000 per job. And that's lower than typical incentives in the U.S. and much lower than Foxconn, which is over $200,000 per job. But then, actually, the bigger part of their package, they said to Amazon, we are going to locate a new campus of Virginia Tech in Northern Virginia. We're going to upgrade our computer science curricula across the state at the state colleges. We're going to upgrade the metro transit services and the highways. And that actually what they devoted the money to, not so much the cash incentives, which I think I'm sure Amazon liked. But this way, Amazon has some assurance they're going to have adequate transportation infrastructure to support the project. They'll be able to get the skilled workers they need. And Virginia also knows that a higher percentage of those jobs will go to state residents. And that's the bottom line. We're not trying to just have growth for the sake of growth. We're trying to create job opportunities for state residents, and we need to focus more of our attention on how to structure these programs so they do that.
And how about making sure that incentives create business where people need jobs?
Right. Well, we also need to target distressed areas. Now, that Virginia didn't really do that with the Amazon thing, but we need to target distressed areas. And some states try to do that. So, for example, North Carolina has tiers of incentives. They divide their counties up into groups. And, you know, the research triangle gets very, very low incentives, or Charlotte, North Carolina, because those areas are doing relatively well. But some of the rural areas of North Carolina that do not have high employment rates and have a lot of poverty and really need jobs, they get a higher incentive per job. And I think that makes a lot of sense, because if you think about it, incentives, if there's more non-employed people who are looking for jobs in an area, then more of the jobs are going to go to people who really need them. If you have an area that already has a low unemployment rate, all the incentive really does is create jobs and lead to in-migration. And while that's necessarily bad, it doesn't necessarily result in an improved employment to population ratio, improved employment rate for state residents.
How about the timing of incentives, upfront versus long-term, step-by-step scaled incentives?
Well, I prefer upfront incentives for two reasons. One, I mean, there's a lot of evidence that companies are myopic, that, you know, providing a tax credit that only pays off 15 years from now, why does the company care? They're not going to be around, you know, the executive that makes decisions is not even around 15 years from now. They're very focused on the stock market today. The other aspect is it's too tempting for governors and mayors to do that. I mean, if you're providing incentive 10 years from now, I mean, it's very tempting to do that because you get the political credit for offering the incentive now, and the next governor or mayor will have to deal with the fiscal consequences. So I think it's too tempting to governors or mayors to get the political benefits now and postpone the cost to the successors. I think you have a much better system where if you're the governor or mayor who's claiming credit for the project, then within your term of office, you're going to have to deal with some of the incentive costs, whatever they are.
In our last few moments, you mentioned a couple positive examples. Are there places where you'd say to a new governor or a new mayor or whatever, city planner, hey, go here, study what they do. They're getting this incentive business right.
Well, I like what Virginia did with Amazon. They have limited incentives. It's a one-time incentive. They have other things. They do customized training. Michigan does customized training. The Carolinas in general do customized job training, which has been shown to be very effective. Both, I mean, companies value customized training is where the local community college helps train workers for the business. And that's a great incentive. Companies really value it. And it also helps make sure that more of the jobs go to local residents, is what we should be trying to maximize.
And then we just have a few moments left. Do you see Amazon and Foxconn deals blowing the roof off here? Are we going to see more mega deals like this?
Well, I think it's up in the air. It depends on how the media, the political system, the public reacts to this. There was some blowback on the Foxconn deal. There was obviously a lot of blowback on the Amazon deal. The thing in New York fell apart. So I think it's up in the air. I mean, you still see states talking about big offers. On the other hand, you see Kansas and Missouri recently agreed to have more of a truce in their incentive wars. They've been regularly having companies go back and forth across the border between in the Kansas City area, bidding, you know, it's kind of a pointless thing. I mean, but, so there has been some progress. I do think that in some states, political forces are leading to somewhat more sane approach to incentives. Let's use them, but use them in a moderate way and combine them with other things that will target more jobs for your local population.
Tim, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
That's Tim Bartik, senior economist at the W.E. Upjohn Institute. He's the author of Making Sense of Incentives. He joined us to look at why business incentives often don't pay off for the states and communities that use them. Here's the scene. You've got a big task ahead of you, the big presentation, the big game, whatever. It's a challenge. In that moment, you might have said or heard that you need to put on your game face. You know, that face you make when you're really just doing something. Turns out, according to some new research, putting on your game face might actually help. Depends on the job, though. Researchers at the University of Tennessee put the idea to the test. According to a statement from researchers, they saw lots of Tennessee football T-shirts with the slogan, "Get your game face on." So being scientists, they didn't just buy a shirt, they set up a study. They showed participants pictures of football players making a determined face, and then they had participants make their own, quote, look of intense determination. They followed that up with physical and mental tests. Physical, they had to hold their hands in very cold water as long as they could. Verdict, the game face, not helpful. The game face people didn't hold their hands in the ice water any longer than the control group. Though, as researchers noted, once everybody put their hands in the really cold water, everybody's face had that look on it. But the mental test, they did black and white crossword puzzles after, again, the game face. The game face group did 20% better. It's just one small study, but it's free and easy to try out. I have just one problem. I was looking at the mirror that Kate Archer Kent has in her office and trying to make a game face, and I don't know how to do it. It just looks kind of goofy, like any time I try to pose for a picture or anything. So I don't have a game face, but you can give yours a try. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.